Thanks. My name is Bob Schuldeis. I am an alcoholic.
To
get the business of AA done, my sobriety date is February 14th, 1980. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. I sponsor other people. I have a home group. I am there every single Friday night, unless there's some reason why I'm out of state or something like that. I truly believe in the philosophy that the only reason for missing the meeting is of your home group is a death in the family, and it ought to be yours. I have two or three other committed meetings that I'm at every single week to work with others, to listen, to keep my mind open, to be able to help to continue to grow. One of the most difficult things that I have as far as sobriety is keeping an open mind and not thinking I know it all. You know, I've been around a few 24 hours. I tend to get, well, you know, I don't need to do this anymore, stuff like that. I believe I was one of those people that I was an alcoholic waiting for the liquid to be able to do its magic. Some people, you know, gradually became alcoholics. I grew up in a home with an awful lot of drinking. I grew up in, you know, being exposed to drinking and sipping, either sipping my father's beer, stealing whatever I could, things like that. But the magic that happened the very first time I drank completely unsupervised was a Halloween party. I was 11 or 12 years old. I'd stolen two bottles of scotch from my father's bar, and because that's what he drank the most of and would miss the least, and I knew that, you know, the whatever's drank in quantity, you won't know how much he drank versus others. And magic happened that night, okay? I was a shy kid. I didn't fit in. I always thought that you had the answer and what was going on, and you were happy-go-lucky, you were this, you were that, and I'm always sitting there feeling totally inadequate, don't fit in, don't feel all, you know. I drank that night, and I asked a girl to dance. I was telling jokes. I was the center of attention. Everybody was going, hey, where have you been before, you know? And this is when my own home, you know? I also, you know, there was that feeling that came over me of, you know, if you read our promises, how do you intuitively handle the situations that used to baffle you? Three drinks. If I just had some alcohol, if I just had enough to drink, I would be fine. And I developed that right from the very first time. And that followed me through all of my drinking for up until the time I got into AA. Anytime I was uncomfortable, anytime I had to go to a family function, anytime I had a test at school, anytime I had a challenge of anything, you know, my secret was, you know, go get a bottle, go drink, you know. The problem is I never stopped at three, ever. That very first night, I stole a cop's motorcycle. I was brought home by the police. I threw up all over myself and everything else around me. I passed out. I blacked out. I don't remember part of the evening. I remember, you know, bits and pieces. And I had so many of the alcoholic word I'm looking for as far as the things, the consequences, all of the alcoholic consequences, I had so many of them that very first night. And that next day, I woke up feeling terrible, you know, absolutely sick as a dog, and I'm already planning how can I do it again, you know. So that was my story. That's how I drank. That's how I did everything. And my drinking career was relatively short. I drank from 11 until I was 24. So it was through high school, you know, grade school, high school. My parents were divorced when I was 9 years old. So My parents did their damnedest to teach me values, teach me right and wrong, teach me what I should be doing in my life. Okay. Every single opportunity I had, I was playing one against the other. I was playing the guilt trip. Well, dad gives me this. Mom gives me this. How come, you know, everything was self-centered around me. I was stealing money from my dad's wallet because as soon as he got drunk at night, he didn't realize how much money he had from the night before. So, you know, my parents didn't teach me to steal. They didn't teach me to lie. They didn't teach me to deceive everybody. They didn't teach me to do all of that. But I was doing all of it. Anything. You know, I couldn't lower my standards fast enough, okay, to not, you know, the twinges of guilt were still there. And I would do anything to be able to just feel okay, you know. And, you know, I wanted to be the big kid on the schoolyard, so I'd steal 20 bucks from my dad's wallet. Back in the 60s and 70s, that was a lot of money. And I'd buy everybody candy at the little corner store. I had to impress you. I had to win you over. I had to try to get you to like me, because you just wouldn't do it if you knew what was really going on inside. And that was my self-esteem. It was what was I was all about. Drinking was, I mean, I already said it. It was the magic elixir of how do you get up to feel okay. I also had a lot of incidences with a lot of crazy stuff. I was 13 years old when my first sister got killed in a car accident by a drunk driver. Okay, and 2.5 years later to the day, another sister got killed by a drunk driver. Okay, and when I was 14 years old, guess who was the worst drunk driver on the road without a driver's license? Okay. Never comprehended that there was something wrong with it because it was what I wanted to do and how I got around, you know. Right through grade school and high school, I started taking geographic cures. The teachers were not tolerating me not showing up to school and not doing homework assignments and not doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And so my grades would start failing, and graduating from eighth grade and going on to high school, my father had himself appointed as chairman of the school board in order to fire the teacher in order to get me to graduate. And that's the only way I moved on to high school. So my father was very politically connected, as well as, you know, I had all of the things going for me, money-wise, prestige-wise, all of that kind of stuff, and still didn't feel like I was that fitting in. So I went to live with my mom, went to live with my dad. My mom lived in upstate New York. My dad lived in Canada, and I was going back and forth between the two of them. And went to live with my mom. Well, she didn't have quite the same amount of money dad is, so I had to go to school, you know, go to work. So I had a part-time job at a grocery store before and after school, and I was stealing 20 and 30 cases of beer out the back door of the grocery store every week because I was the popular man on campus. You know, hey, invite Bob to the party because he's got beer, and I had plenty of it. I made sure I had plenty of it, you know, and the trunk of my car was loaded. I had a little minor problem that kept showing up all the way from the time that I first got my driver's license till I got into these rooms. I kept wrecking cars. In 8 years of legal driving, I totaled 17 vehicles. And I never got convicted of DUI, which I should have been every single time. It was a different time and era in those days. And I never got hurt. I got a few scratches, a few bruises here and there, stuff like that. Literally after one of the car accidents where I totaled a tractor trailer, totaled the back end of my car into a tractor trailer in a snowstorm, the teacher and my principal from the high school came to my mom's house to say condolences because what was left of my car was left in a parking lot right next to the school. And I was so drunk, I crawled into the doghouse and slept with the St. Bernard in the snow. You know, Mom didn't know what the heck was, you know. No, he's right there, drunk. We don't know what to do with him. My parents were fed up. They didn't know what to do with me. You know, my mom and my stepfather, he had it with sand. I was lying to him. I was cheating. I was stealing. I was in trouble. I was an embarrassment. And they lived in a very small town in upstate New York, and I was an embarrassment to them. They were business people, and they were always having to explain what the heck I was doing, you know. And, you know, so ended up having a fight with my father, with my stepfather, moved back to good Canada, go live with my father. Things weren't much better there for very long. I had a 1930 Model A Ford. It was all stock, all original. And I loaded, I went, got up to go to school one morning, and it was 42 below zero. And just nasty, and we walked to school. And I turned around, came home, and I put all my belongings in that Model A Ford, and I moved to Florida. And that's how I immigrated to the United States. I got a job working at a bank in Florida, in Orlando, and I started making a lot of money. Not legally, but I started selling mortgage information to the bank, you know, and doing a bunch of crooked deals and a bunch of stuff. And I was, you know, had a nice little salary, but I was at the bars all the way around Orlando and Disney and everything else every single night. Most of the time I was passed out in my car, and they woke me up on the way into the bank in the morning. And I was living, you know, living the American dream. I had a big fat wallet, and I was making money, and I was partying, and I was, you know, all of the great things that go along with drinking. The typical morning when I woke up, came to, if I felt that way this morning, I'd go to the hospital, you know. I mean, I would call an ambulance and I would go to the hospital. The head, the nausea, the sickness, you can't focus, everything like that. And I considered that a normal, fair consequence for the way I was able to be able to party and live and have a great time. I lived in Orlando for 2.5 years and I got deported. You know, ended up back in Canada in the middle of winter, no less. And I got a great job. I made some great money, and I had, you know, by the time I was 23 years old, I had 3 apartment buildings. I had a high-rise condo in downtown Toronto. I had a house in the country, and I had 5 cars in the underground parking lot. And I was living high on the hog and traveling the East Coast and making some really, really good money. And I went to Las Vegas to go gamble for Christmas. And I took a whole bunch of money with me, and I didn't have enough money in all my normal accounts, so I took it out of my tax account. The Canadian government is not as nice as the IRS. I came back from that trip to Las Vegas, and I owned nothing. I could have paid the bill with a written check, and I could have paid off everything. But no, Mr. Schuldeis, you're guilty of tax evasion, taking the money out of the country. Do you want to sacrifice all your assets, or do you want to go to jail for 5 years? And my brain says no drinking. That was it, no drinking. So I walked away from a life at 23 years old. I had credit cards. You know, I had no rambunction running up credit card debt. And it was about 6 or 8 months later that I washed ashore at my mom's house. I had the clothes on my back. I didn't have a car. I didn't have 2 nickels to rub together. And I said, Mom, I need a place to stay. And, you know, my mom didn't know what to do with me. And you got to understand that every time I went to visit my mother during those periods of time, you know, she would always ask, well, but, you know, Robert, that's a nice brand new car. What happened to the old one? Oh, I totaled it. This is the same woman who lost 2 daughters in car accidents killed by drunk drivers. And every single time I'm visiting her, I've got a brand new car because I totaled the last one. You know, you think of what I put her through just in the fear of losing another child. She didn't know what to do. She and my sister actually got together with somebody that they knew and they ganged up on the family and said, you've got to cut them loose. You got to kick them out. You got to put them on the street. And so my sister and my mom came home one day and said, you either go to Alcoholics Anonymous, call this number, or get up. And so I went to my very first AA meeting in Livonia, New York, in September of 1979. And those people were really nice. You know, they welcomed me at the meeting. They devoted the meeting to me, talking about the first step and what alcoholism is and what alcoholism does, and come on back, and did everything that a good AA group and a good AA meeting does. One of the guys actually invited me over to his house that night, and we sat there till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning talking about my drinking. But you know what they talked about? They opened the meeting with a prayer. And they closed the meeting with a prayer. And they kept talking about God during the meeting. You know, higher power, God. You know, I saw religion. I saw closed-mindedness of mine. I saw all of the things all the prejudices that I had against every single religion were sitting here and saying, well, you might need this. And that might be work just fine for you, but I don't need this crap, okay? Most of this, I did not have a religious upbringing. Most of this was from my two sisters' funerals. My one sister was actually she was engaged to a young man who was Catholic, and she was going through all of the catechisms and all of the stuff to become a Catholic to be able to marry this man. And I'm at her funeral at 13 years old, listening to this Catholic priest going, well, this is God's will, and we have to accept God's will. And I'm going through it saying, well, you know, if that's what God's will, I really don't want it, okay? It's not what I've signed on for. You know, 2.5 years later, a Protestant minister in Canada at another funeral for my other sister, and I am as drunk as a skunk. My best friends I grew up with are carrying me into the funeral parlor in the church. And guess what? This minister, oh, it's God's will. You know, I spent a lot of time from that point on studying religion, and I could tell you from any bar stool why you were a damned idiot to believe that stuff. That wasn't the way I put it in those days, but, you know, only a weakling believes in that stuff. Only anybody who can stand on their own 2 feet doesn't believe in that stuff, you know. And I don't debate, you know, any kind of religion with you on any format up until the time, you know, I got into the rooms of AA. You know, the focus of my first meeting was the first step. Powerless over alcohol. Powerless. You know, I could show you all of the things I did drinking and all of the things when I should not have had a drink. And I went ahead and did it. Okay. And I had a guy who was working with me during that time who kept saying, Bob, do you believe your life is unmanageable, drunk or sober? Well, drunk, I could get you below this. 17 cars, kicked out of school, kicked out of this, losing jobs. All of these things I could tell you all about. And he said, how about your relationship with your family? How about your relationship with your coworkers? How do the people that you know that care about you, how do you treat them? How do they respect you? Can you actually get along with them? Where is all this anger coming from? Where is all this pride coming from that you feel that you're being treated inadequately? And that they're not treating you properly. Where's all of these, take any of these 7 deadly sins that are all through, you know, our steps, our literature, and mainly in the 4th step that says, you know, these are the things that are inadequate about me that make me, that my life is unacceptable, and I am not a friend among friends. I'm not a family member. I am me, and you are all the enemy. You know, and that's the way my brain worked. And these people, gotta give, you know, it was a small town, country atmosphere. They came and got me when I didn't have a car. They had made sure that I got to meetings 3, 4, 5 days a week. They were, you know, I'd go out and walk the dogs an hour before the meeting. And there was one guy who used to come out with his 4-wheel drive truck coming out to the fields to get me to make sure I got to a meeting that night. They did everything to try to get me to go to meetings. But, you know, you read our 12 steps. I can see where my life is a total disaster. I can even see where it's unmanageable. But I don't want your solution. Your solution says, hey, you know, come to believe that a power greater than yourself is going to restore you to sanity. Well, I'm first off, you know, the alcoholic sanity is two-part. It's the what's you happens when you pick up the first drink, and it's what happens when an alcoholic is trying to stay sober on his own without any kind of treatment. And I've spent more time in that alcoholic insanity, you know, rationalizing why I could drink, who the hell are you to tell me I can't drink, what is going, you know, all of the kind of inadequacies, all of the feelings. Because, you know, the AA being very, very unfair. You surrender, and the only option we got for you is a power greater than yourself. You know, and I had great sponsorship, and I had great people reaching out to me, but I didn't want it. I spent more time contemplating suicide in that the 5 months after I first got into AA, because I'll never have fun again. There's what, you know, you can't go bowling without a drink. How does he do anything? There's nothing you could ever do that didn't, you know, involve alcohol. Not in my mind, since I was 11 years old. If I'd gone to a wedding, a funeral, a party, a work event, a social event, anything going on, if it didn't have booze, I didn't go. You know, and so you take away the booze component, all of my coping mechanisms were gone. All of my ability to be able to get along with everything and everybody were totally gone. And the only option, well, you know, first step, powerless over alcohol. My life is unmanageable, drunk or sober. Do you believe that a power greater than yourself can restore you to sanity? You know? Can you turn your will? Do you trust the process? Do you have enough faith to say, God, please take this crap? Well, I got drunk 5 months later, and I had a whole series of consequences happen that last morning. I'd gone out. I don't know whether it was 2, 3, or 4 six-packs of beer. The corner store was right next to my little shack in the ghetto in Rochester. I had gotten a job as a car salesman in 1979 with, you know, 22% interest, and no one was buying anything that wasn't going on in those days, and so I've just lost my car. I woke up feeling like dirt, and I had promised to make coffee at a Sunday morning AA meeting at 11 a.m. A service position right off the very bat saved my life. Because I got up and I found a way and I got over to my home group. I showed up with the donuts because the coffee maker brought the donuts, set up the coffee. We had a classy meeting. I mean, we served coffee and cream and sugar. We're on all the tables around the room, and my type of meeting, you know. I showed up 2 hours early, and I set the room up, and I wrote a little note saying, thank you very much. Here's the key. I quit. You know. Now, what are the chances that on a February morning, somebody else shows up 2 hours early for an AA meeting? No, coincidence. Gotta be, right? Frank McDonald, long past, came into that meeting and said, I was supposed to be meeting somebody for breakfast. It fell through. How you doing? And I stayed for the meeting. And we got talking and everything, and Frank says, how about coming over for dinner with me and my family tonight? I said, okay, but I got to go someplace. He says, where are you going? I said, Frank, I really don't know. I have to go someplace. And so I left the meeting, and I went to a part of Rochester, New York that I'd never been to before, to what looked like an abandoned grocery store, where there was a Southern Black Baptist church service going on. And it looked like a rundown grocery store. And I didn't know the area. I didn't know the people. I didn't really know how I got there. I walked into this church service, and everybody greeted me. Welcome. Come on in. Sit down. You know, and I'm sitting there shaking. I'm hungover still from the night before. I'm feeling like dirt. I'm feeling, you know, really crappy. And, you know, how long is it? How long is the church service? An hour long? I can get out of here. I can hang out an hour. I'll get out of here. Well, this church service is going on 2 hours. It was going on 3 hours. It was still going on. And the minister's going, well, you know, this is going to happen to you, and you're fighting this, and you have this. You know, and making all these predictions. And I'm going, yeah, right, yeah, right. You know, the typical closed-mindedness of this type of alcoholic going, I don't know, you don't know what you understand. And finally, I grabbed my coat, and I started to walk out the door, and I stood up. And the minister said, sit down, I'm not done with you yet. And I just dropped. I mean, I dropped back to the chair. He finished talking to somebody over here, and he looks at me, and he says, you, stand up. And I did. And he says, you don't believe in God, do you? And he says, and you're one of them alcoholic or drug addict types, aren't you? Yeah. I shook my head. He said a whole bunch of other stuff, and to this day I can't tell you what all he said beside those two sentences. Okay. When he was done, I ran. I just ran. And I went and I ran down and I had dinner with Frank McDonald and his wife, and who was also in the program for many years, and is actually one of his kids were in the program. And I didn't even mention what had just happened. I didn't mention to anybody what had just happened for almost 3 years. Okay. I didn't know whether it was hallucination, whether it was true, whether it was anything, you know. But it changed my perception such that instead of saying, no, no way, I was going, okay, maybe. And it opened the door of willingness just enough that I was willing to at least hear what you had to say. So when the AA group was going, Bob, just believe in us. We'll be there for you. You know, try electricity. Try the, you know, it's got to be bigger than you. And during that process, I actually heard one of my favorite AA speakers. I went to a convention in Rochester that was their very first AA convention, and a gentleman that probably a lot of you have heard, Sadie Beach, okay, spoke at that convention, and I took home his idea of spirituality, okay, and that spirituality got me to where I was able to start working the rest of the steps with some kind of faith in a power that's in these rooms. When I look at the miracles in these rooms, every single one of us here tonight are supposed to be drunk right now. Okay? Every single one of us, by our nature, on our own, are supposed to be drunk. Without the power that I have been given and shared within these rooms, there is no way that I would be sober on my own if it were not for Alcoholics Anonymous and what's going on in these rooms and the teachings and the sharing that is going on in these rooms to be able to continue to grow and become a better person. I already told you I was a pretty shitty person coming in these rooms. You know, for those 7-8 years where I was working and coming in here, you know, there weren't many things I did that are, you know, let's put it this way. I've listened to a lot of fourth and fifth steps, okay? I have not found anybody I've done a fourth and fifth step who has been in the shit I have been in, okay? So, you know, and I've had a lot of sponsors. And the reason I've had a lot of sponsors, if you hang around these rooms a long time, your sponsors die on you. My current sponsor, when I asked him, because he and I were both close friends with Dale Scott. And Dale was my sponsor before Mike Hannon. And I walked up to Mike and I said, will you be my sponsor? He says, no, you killed too many of them. So he is my sponsor now, and we've been together working for a long time. Alcoholics Anonymous, through patience, love, acceptance, and showing me the way. You know, I had a sponsor in the early days by the name of Chris Adams, and Chris used to say all the time, he says, Bob, it's a very, very fine line between taking somebody's inventory and being observant. He says, how do you know what you want if you don't watch the people in the rooms? How do you know, you know, there's a lot of people in these rooms that have been sober a long while that I don't want what they have. And there's a lot of people in these rooms who are new in the first couple of years, and they got it going, and they're doing the right things, and they're getting it together, and they're getting, you know. And so I'm able to say, what is that one doing, and what is that one doing? And I don't do what they do, and I do what that one is showing, you know. And that's my sponsor, and that's my home group. We got a really, really tight core home group. It's Friday night at 8 o'clock. If you get into Richmond, right at 288 and 711, Bon Air Baptist Church. And it's a weird name, and if you got an hour, I'll explain it to you. But the group's called Wet Birds Moving On. And come on out. We got a great core of AA people who are work the steps, work with others, have their hand out, and are doing the right things. That group I go to every Friday night unless I'm out of town. Just so happens I'm leaving for Arkansas in the morning, and I am going to be missing it next week, but I'll be back the following week. Every home group member in that meeting knows I will not be there next Friday night. Okay, I don't just not show up. How are they going to keep track of me and say, hey, Bob, where were you, if they don't know that I was supposed to be there? Developing a faith in a higher power for me was the most difficult thing I've ever done in this program. You know, everybody says the fourth and fifth step is tough and this is tough. I had such a closed mind that my developing in faith in this program was done through trial and error and pain. You go to the meetings and you see the 12 steps on the wall. Those 12 steps had nothing to do with what was wrong with me. My thinking. Okay. I did not need a spiritual awakening. I did not need a moral inventory. I did not need to make amends. I did not need any of that kind of stuff that was up there. I needed a small loan. I needed a better job. I needed a prettier girlfriend. I needed something. I needed things. And had you given me a list of all of the things that were important that I wanted when I came in these rooms, there none of the spiritual values that I have today that I value would have been on that list. None of them. It was all things. I was looked for the flash. I looked for the money. I looked for the power. I looked for all of that stuff. Spiritual values were not on there, you know. So coming to those turning points where I am so angry with a coworker, I mean, I'm waking up dreaming about the situations and having battles in my mind with somebody who's not there about a discussion that has not happened, okay? That, I mean, I'm waking up and I get on my knees and please, please, God, I don't care what's going on. Please take this. And next morning I go to work and he's got a promotion and a transfer and I never had to deal with him again. Those are the kind of miracles that have happened every single time I let go. God and AA do not come in and fix my problems. It is a spiritual solution in which my problem goes away, disappears, becomes insignificant. Instead of having a problem, I have a world with a problem in it. Okay? And my higher power, Alcoholics Anonymous, allows me to do that. How does it do that? I look at the problem and I say, is there anything I can do about it? Powerless. Yes, no. Can God fix it? If I'm powerless over it, I can't, so it better be him. Ask him to do it. Please, God, take this. What's my part in it? Oh, fourth step. What's my part in it? Let's do an inventory. If I still can't let it go, and if I'm still in turmoil about it, what is my part in it? Is it my pride? Is it my fear? Is it lust? Is it greed? Is it envy? Is it sloth? Whatever the heck the character defect is that is being triggered, that is making me feel inadequate, that is getting through to my skin, that is pissing me off in some way or another. Excuse my language. I'm supposed to keep it clean. what is it that is, you know, got it upset with me? If it's something significant, I better sit down and talk with somebody because I can't leave it in my brain and it gets solved. I have to share it with somebody. That fifth step is essential. They give me a perspective coming out. Sometimes just putting it into words instead of letting it scramble around in my head solves it. But in most cases, talking to my sponsor, talking to the people I trust, and say, this is what's going on. The answer is clear. Okay. What is the character defect that needs attention? Okay. Sixth and seventh step. To me, it's the most underworked steps in AA. And it's probably the most powerful step for the power to change. Okay. There is nothing in AA that does more to change you than seeing the continuous, repeated Bob jerk coming out where I'm insulting people, I'm inconsiderate, I'm pushing my will, I'm lazy, I'm intolerant, I'm whatever the heck's going on of all of these things. What's my part in it? Well, you know, I have never developed a strict relationship with my God. He does not come to me and say, Bob, you really need to do this. Okay. Has not seen fit to do that yet. 39 years and counting, he has not done that yet. But when I'm at an AA meeting and a topic comes up, I'm going, okay, God, thank you very much. I get the words. I get the direction. I get the checks and balance. I get the all of the stuff that is needed in these rooms when I'm here. And I hear somebody sharing about what the heck's going on. What am I in conflict with? I have never, ever been able to get up in the morning and saying, I am not going to let fear bother me today. I am not going to let pride bother me today. I am not going to be lustful. I am not going to be greedy. Okay? It is amazing that when I ask for help on that sixth and seventh step, and my sponsor puts me through it every couple of years, for 30 days, I get out the big book and say the seventh step prayer for every single one of my character defects. And I do it morning and night for 30 days. And if I miss a day, a morning or a night, I start the clock over. Well, I'm a very, very diligent AA member. It usually takes me 6 to 8 months to get through my 30 days. So it's usually a very long exercise. Okay. But the end result is that I'm seeing the nasties that Bob is still doing that God can help with. And I'm getting to that point where, just like that very first time with that guy at work, God, I don't want this. Please, please take it. And amazingly, that it's not bothering me as much. My character defects haven't been removed by any means, but they're tolerable. I can live with them. I'm comfortable. I'm doing the right thing. I'm treating my wife with respect. I'm trying to help her do her life and be there for her. My sister is going through problems, so I'm able to be able to help my sister out. I'm going to jump back for a minute. When I first got sober, I didn't have a car. I didn't even have a way to get to work. I didn't have anything. And my sister took me into her apartment to allow me to live there long enough until I could afford a place of my own. When I was just in that first 5 months when it was hell, okay, my sister, and I didn't really realize how bad it was, from the time that before I was 9 years old, I used to chase her with a butcher knife. And if I'd been able to, I would have killed her. Okay, my pride was so hurt, the inadequacies were so bad, that I would have killed that woman. Okay. Today she is my absolute best friend. She is there for me. We hang out together. We go to Ocracoke together. We do all kinds of stuff together. She's now celebrating 18 years sobriety, and I was able to be the one who dropped the hint that maybe she might want to try it. Okay. I've never been her sponsor, never been her spiritual advisor, anything like that, but I was able to be there with her husband to say, hey, maybe you got a drinking problem. And she's got sober on August 10th of 1981. And being able to be there for her and have her in my life is just incredible. It's gifts of sobriety. I've talked a little bit about that sixth and seventh step. I believe that that's where I have the power to change. I do not have that power to change on my own. Eighth and ninth step, you know. please, please do not do a ninth step until you, unless you've talked to your sponsor. Okay? Don't do a ninth step unless you've gone 4 through 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I got sober and I was out to get, you know, the motives hadn't changed just because I was sober. Well, this person's got a job. Maybe I'll go make amends to them. This girl's real pretty. Maybe I'll go make amends to them and maybe I can get laid. This one here is this. Maybe I can get some of that, you know. Every single amend that I made amends for in the first few weeks when I was sober, I had to go back and make amends for again. Because the motives were wrong. I put the wrong things as priorities. I had all of the, you know, every single one of them were selfish motives. None of it was trying to clean up my side of the street and be a better person to these people. Okay. So I strongly suggest that if you're even thinking about amends, unless it's something you did this morning, okay, that you sit with your sponsor, you talk through those amends, you talk what part is it of mine, what is it I'm supposed to be doing, and then go in to make those amends. 10, 11, and 12 is where I try to live every day. You know, I am not perfect. I owe my wife amends on a regular basis because there's something I say or do. Fortunately, she's sober too, and she does her own, and we still get along really, really, really well. This is my third marriage, okay? I didn't do that well over the first two. And I was sober for both of them, so I cannot blame drinking on either one of those marriages falling apart. One was a really bad choice on my part, and the other one was I did stuff that, you know, shouldn't have been done, and we both went our separate ways, and she left me. It is not a case of, hey, I got this big book under my arm, I got a nice sober little girl, let's go off and go have a fairyland romance. It takes work. It takes mutual respect. It takes friendship. That's the big thing difference with my wife today is we are truly friends. We can't stand being away from one another. All right? She's been down in Arkansas for 2 weeks. Her dad passed away recently, and she's trying to clean up the estate. And now she's visiting her daughter and grandkids, which just she's thrilled with and having a great time. You know, she does things that I don't agree with. You know what? She's entitled to. She's entitled to. As a sponsor I had in the early days, I was complaining about my first wife one day, and he says, Bob, does she put up with your stuff? Well, yeah. He says, then give her any damn thing she wants. You know, I have a great life today. As Tom came out here with me tonight, and I have the blessing of being able to work with Tom, I just have so many gifts, you know. That mother I was talking about who I kept crashing cars and scaring her to death and everything else, she passed away about 3 years ago. And she passed a nasty death with Alzheimer's where she just went down. She had an accident and then surgery, and then she just went down terribly. And my sister took most of the brunt of that because I was working out of state. And when I was sober a couple of years, and after I had done that eighth and ninth step with a sponsor, I went to my mom and I said, Mom, you know, I stole from you. I lied to you. I did terrible things. I put fear in you with all the drinking and driving. I did all of these things. And she just says, stop, 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 stop. I said, what? She says, please, whatever you're doing, please keep doing it. You're the one kid I don't have to worry about anymore. Okay? There's no compliment that is no greater than that. There's nothing that cuts through to the heart. I mean, my eyes were leaking. I was, you know, blubbering like an idiot because, you know, I was making my mother's life better. Because of my behavior of trying to do the next right thing, of trying to be there for her, of trying to do the next right thing. You know, I have a great job. I've moved all over. You know, I got sober in Rochester, New York. I moved down to Richmond. for my work. I've been working in Iowa, Washington, you know, stuff like that. I come back to my home group, and it's like coming home. Those people are there for me. Their hands are out. The big hugs. We missed you. We stay in touch. We do, you know, I have blessings beyond all my wildest dreams. I would not trade the life I have today for anyone I've ever known, anyone I've ever met. That's just, the gifts are inside. You know, the ability to be happy is inside. The 12 steps are the solution. You know, I work with anybody that I'm working with, and is sponsor or not, or just in an AA meeting, and, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is not a problem-solving organization. We don't solve anybody's problems, just like they didn't solve mine. We are a solution-working organization. We work a spiritual solution, the problem goes away, becomes insignificant. It just, it's not a big deal anymore. I'm comfortable even with the turmoil. The phrase I've heard is serenity is not freedom from the storm, it's peace amidst it. Storms going on around me, I'm okay in the shoes I'm in, and the blessings I have, and the life I have. You know, I would not trade what I have for anything. Now, I'm running out of things to say. I do have to tell you that of all of the different service positions I have held through all of Alcoholics Anonymous, speaking is my least favorite. Okay, so. I thank you for inviting me up here, Sam, and it's been a really good meeting a whole bunch of new, brand new friends. So thank you very much. Thank you, God.